You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The latest issue of the literary magazine Grant is called The Best of Young American Novelists 2. Joining me now is Ian Jack, the editor of Granta. Over the course of his four decades in journalism and literature, his jobs have included reporter, editor, features writer, foreign correspondent, and publisher. It's my great pleasure to welcome him to our show. Hi.
It's very nice to be here. Thank you.
And this is the second Granta issue devoted to American novelists. So do you plan to do one? Well, you're leaving, I gather, but is the plan to do one every 10 years?
We will do one every 10 years. It began, actually, in 1983 in Britain, when we did Best of Young British Novelists, which was then regarded, I think, as rather a kind of vulgar idea for publishing, really, a list of people who were considered to be the best. And it was worked. It was a great success. It introduced lots of young writers who wouldn't otherwise perhaps be quite as well known as they are. And then we did it again in 1993, and then we did the first Best of Young American in 1996.
Are American writers as well known in Britain as British writers? Because it does work the other way. Some of the most famous British writers are big stars here.
Yes. Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, one of the reasons that Granta became a successful magazine was the fact that it introduced a lot of people in Britain to writers like Richard Ford, Raymond Carver, Jane Ann Phillips in the early 80s. I'm not saying they weren't known then in Britain, but they certainly weren't as well known as they became in later in that decade. And I think vice versa, as it were, the other trade going across the other way across the Atlantic was that people here got to hear of Julian Barnes, Kingsley Amis, Kashi Shiguro, people like that, Ian McEwan, and I guess Salman Rushdie. Whether that still is quite true, I mean, the last sort of big, I would think, young American author to make it in Britain would be Jonathan Safran Foer, who's on our list. But I think on this particular list, because the writers are under 35, not so many would be known in Britain. Although, I have to say, almost every one of them is published there.
And on the cover, it says Best Young American Novelist 2, now even younger.
Yes,
that's the selling point. And you also, all of the type is borrowed from American advertising.
Yes, this was thought to be ironic. I don't know whether, do you think it works? Do you think it's...
Well, it suggests that they're more commercial than, I think, than Jonathan Franzen would like people to think American writers are.
Well, perhaps. It was a kind of jest, that, I must say. And it seems to have been taken mainly as that as well. It does look like a kind of advertising hoarding. But it's meant irony is a very difficult thing and doesn't always travel. I think this one works, though.
Well, when you do choose a best of anything, you wind up putting yourself out on a limb because then it's assumed that these people are going to fare very well in the future. And I'm assuming, I don't know the whole list of the last selection, but I'm assuming most of them did quite well. Some probably have disappeared and some you wish you had included, who, because they become giant successes, and you decided at the time not to include them.
I wish that all the time with the 96 list in this country. I mean, we didn't have Michael Chabon, we didn't have David Foster Wallace, we didn't even have Nicholson Baker. And I think that was a mistake. But you can never get everything right. That's one of the lessons of this, that you'll get some things completely, because posterity is a very difficult thing to judge for, really.
Well, you're choosing some very well-known writers here, but also some who aren't all that well-known in this country. So you're kind of discovering them, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, I hope that's one thing we can do. We can introduce good writers to a bigger audience than they would otherwise have had by saying they're on this list. Being on this list can work in different ways for writers. I remember one writer in England who said that after he'd been announced as the best young British novelist, he felt that writing after that was like standing naked on a plinth in Trafalgar Square trying to have an erection. Obviously, we don't want that to happen
too
often.
I tried that once. It didn't work.
Didn't work? I would imagine it's a very difficult thing to do. I've never actually tried it myself. So it can have kind of odd effects being on this list, but I think by and large, it's a good thing to be on. I think it does writers a lot of good.
So how many writers were considered for the 21 slots here? You must have had some criteria other than being under 35 and having made some kind of a reputation.
Well, we read, I would think the judges read about 75. I read many more than that because we tried to weed out the list to make it kind of manageable for the judges in the end. I guess in the office we must have read about 150 books by young writers under the age of 35. Of course, one of the things it brings into question is this word literature and the literary novel. What is the literary novel? What is literature? And perhaps on a radio show of this length, it's best not to get into that. But I think what you're looking for is a writer that's trying to in some way illuminate and re-describe life. I mean, that's the D.H. Lawrence thing about the novel being the great bright book of life, I think, comes into anybody's consideration of what a literary novel is. I mean, ironically, or paradoxically rather, a lot of these writers were actually not novelists. I mean, there's quite a lot of short story writers.
Even though you say novelists, you could have said best American fiction writers, couldn't you?
We could have said that. It seemed a bit clumsy to say that, but we could have said that. And perhaps more honestly, we should have said that, because quite a lot of these people are very good short story writers. Quite a few of them, like Zizi Packer, have yet to write a novel, although she's working on one. But I think you have to look at the writing and decide, well, this looks of such promise that one day she will write a novel, one day he will write a novel.
I want to get back to that whole business about literary novels, because Grant got caught up in the whole debate about the death of the novel some years back. I hope that that has been laid to rest. Still, the British novel seems to be fairly healthy, although most of the recent Booker winners seem to have been from outside of England, including the United States.
Yes.
But do you think that since Americans don't argue this as much, in fact, the only person to have really try to make a case for it recently in American book reviews was V.S. Naipaul, who I think is British.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that's no longer an issue, or are we going to keep on going? Does this group put the lie to that idea?
The idea that the novel is dying or is dead is a recurrent one, you know, every 10 years. I mean, I know that Naipaul has said that very eloquently, that the days of a novelist like Tolstoy describing the society he comes from to the people who live in that society, so it's a very vital activity, those days are gone. And maybe they are, you know, one doesn't know about this. You could argue, and I sometimes think in my bleaker moments, that actually literary writing, I mean, it's always been quite a middle-class activity for a middle-class audience, so one can never make too high a claim for it, but the literary novel is now, I sometimes think, a bit like watercolour painting used to be to certain Victorian women, that it was a kind of social accomplishment. And in the States, you have this huge kind of fiction, these great fiction factories in creative writing skills, which produce lots and lots and lots of writing. How much of this writing actually matters in a kind of social rather than artistic sense, I wouldn't know. I think one interesting thing about these, I mean, I think they're very fine writers, this list of 21, obviously I do, but I think one thing I felt reading those and the rest of them was that American popular culture, which is such a huge part of this country, was something that nobody really wanted to tackle. And that I think 7 out of 21 of these writers were born or raised abroad, Peru, China, Africa, India. And I think from that you get a kind of feeling of they're telling you things you didn't know before, which is a kind of good basic requirement of writing, I think. And I think that's one reason, perhaps, for the success here. But they're not telling you about the great, great mass of American popular culture, which is such, as I said, such a big thing here. And maybe there's a kind of fear of doing that. Maybe it can't be done properly.
But also the emigre experience has become a major theme in American literature almost pretty much from the start.
Yeah.
And so that shouldn't come as all that much of a surprise. But how do we determine what's an American writer? Is Salman Rushdie an Indian writer because he was born there, a British writer because he established himself there, or an American writer because he's been living here for quite a while?
Good question. I think all you can say is that he's a writer in English. I think, he's a kind of globalized person, Salman Rushdie. I mean, he was born in India, as you say, grew up in Britain largely at school in Britain, went to university in Britain, published first in Britain, now lives in New York most of the time. I mean, he's an English writer, a writer in English, which is a different thing.
Well, you lived in India for a while, and Salman Rushdie also has claimed that writers from the former British colonies like India have given new life to English writing, especially British writing.
Yes, I think that's true. I think they have. I think that these things are quite tricky to... You can only speculate about them, I suppose, really. But I think what Salman Rushdie did for a lot of people in India was he made writing seem like a possible career. He made it. He gave them kind of permission to describe India to the outside world in a literary way. Now, of course, that had been done before he came, but he really kind of established it because he became so famous. And I think when people... You know, as I said before, I think when people are describing things freshly for the first time, there's a kind of freshness in what they write, which makes it automatically interesting to an audience.
My guest is Ian Jack, who is the editor of Granta magazine, the British Quarterly, and their latest edition is Best of Young American Novelists 2, now even younger, just out on your newsstands. Well, your background has been in journalism. Had you written fiction before you took over Granta?
I hope I've never knowingly written fiction. What happened with me and Granta was I was editing a newspaper called The Independent Sunday in London.
You kind of started that newspaper.
Yeah, I was helped to found it. That's true. Two or three of us did it. But I'd written for Bill Buford, my predecessor at Granta, a few times, and I knew him, and I knew the magazine. So when I came to think about changing my life a bit and doing something else when I was just about to be 50, I thought Bill left, went to the New Yorker, and I was lucky enough to be given the job to edit Granta, which I think is an amazing privilege. It's something I've loved doing for 12 years now.
Well, is a background in journalism good preparation for running a literary magazine? I'm thinking about Philip Gurevich, also an investigative journalist who's now the editor of the Paris Review.
Yes.
This is a trend here.
Yes, maybe we started a trend here. Yeah, you're right. I don't know. I think one of the things it does, actually, it gives you a great interest in nonfiction, which can be useful in some ways and not so useful in others. I remember when I first came from a newspaper to Granta, I read something that Bill had written, and the question in a newspaper is usually, is it true? The question in a different kind of writing, literary writing, is it believable? These are two different things. And what you tend to look for, I suppose, in Granta or in a literary magazine or in literature generally, is you want to be persuaded, whether in fiction or indeed in nonfiction, that something, that your belief has been... disbelief, rather, has been suspended for a while. Those are two different things, and I think it's taken me quite a while to kind of disentangle this proposition in my own head. But, you know, I think that nonfiction has become really part of what you might call literary canon in the last 20 years, travel.
Although there's also the matter of style, and fiction tends to play a lot looser with style than nonfiction. Once in a while, I come across a work of nonfiction that is written beautifully, but mm-hmm. more often than not, if you really want gorgeous prose, you're going to go to some of the best writers of fiction, aren't you?
You are. But it's interesting how fiction, the novel, has influenced nonfiction. A lot of fictional devices, like the establishment of character, the scene, dialogue, narration, have been imported, I think, into many forms of nonfiction, especially, I think, the biggest, if they can be called culprits, the biggest forms, I suppose, would be memoir and travel writing. And you see in both those forms just how much has been borrowed from the novel.
I want to get back to the British-English, the British-American thing, because Bill Buford is an American, and he brought a lot of American writers to this British magazine, but also thinking about some of the British writers I've interviewed, people like Martin Amis, who cites Saul Bellow and other Americans as some of his most powerful influences, although some might say Kingsley Amis was his most powerful influence. Still, there seems to be a much more of a cross-fertilization now than there was, we'll say, 30 or 40 years ago. Am I wrong?
Well, just going back even before then, and if you look at books by, say, Sinclair Lewis, Upton Sinclair, in the 20s that were published in England, you'd find they came with a little glossary of terms. You know, what does faucet mean? What does sidewalk mean? And that's when the two cultures were really, really quite separate.
But even the interests of the literature seemed to be quite different.
Yes. Well, I think the truth, sad or otherwise, is that Britain and the States have become much more similar as societies. That's one thing. I also think that America was very blessed to have people like Bellow and to still have Roth and Richard Ford and Updike. These are considerable fiction writers. And I don't think anybody in that same post-war era in England quite measured up to them. And they were a very big influence, I think, on English writers, especially Martin Amis. I think now that they are, I mean, they're old, many of them, and Bellow's dead, I think that kind of worship of that particular way of American writing may be disappearing. And I think England, because it's kind of a more chaotic place in a way, at least in terms of writerly training, it's socially more chaotic also sometimes, I think, is producing quite a lot of fresh, interesting things, which, I mean, people like Zadie Smith, for instance, has had some effect, I think, here. And maybe, although this is a vain thing to say, or even a chauvinistic thing to say, maybe there's a kind of more freedom of form in Britain now than there is in the States, although I think that, too, is changing. I think that one thing this Granter collection demonstrates, really, is that a kind of American writing, which was very much influenced by Raymond Carver and was the kind of king of creative writing skills for a long time, which is social realism of a certain kind of American way of life, I think that has, it's not disappeared, it's not, hasn't vanished, but I think it's much less now than it was 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, most of those trends do run their course. Magical realism has run its course. Carver, that Carver approach has pretty much run its course, although somebody may come along and revive it in a way that will be totally startling.
Yes, yes. Well, these things do.
So what trend do you see here?
In terms of, this is what I like, really. So this is a very subjective judgment. I'm not a great fan of magical realism, and I'm not a great fan, this may strike you as an odd thing to say, I'm not a great fan of the over-fertile imagination. Quite a lot of the books we read showed a kind of, almost like, you almost wanted to kind of sign in front of these books saying, danger, over-fertile imagination at work.
This is from a man from the country that gave us Harry Potter.
Indeed, indeed. Well, there we are. I can only apologize for that. What I like is what has to be called the realistic novel, really. And I think there's lots of evidence that you can be realistic about different kinds of things. We had some novels, not writers chosen on the list, who were really, really kind of formally experimental. And I think an interesting thing about the novel really is that in Britain anyway, and I think largely it's true here as well, it's not a subsidized art form. It really has to find an audience. So you can't have the kind of Tate Modern of the novel if it's to work. I mean, Finnegan's Wake would really be hard-pressed now, I think, to find a publisher. I mean, whether that's good or bad, different discussion, but I think it really would be hard-pressed. I think novels need to be sold, and they need to have an audience, they need to find their audiences. And I think that, in a way, has kept them quite honest as art forms. Or you could argue another way, that it's also kept them quite conservative as art forms. But I think realism, and there's different forms of it in this Granter collection, is the thing that I notice most now in new American writing and in new British writing.
And some of the writers included here, I don't know whether I should read all 21 names, but Daniel Alarcon, Judy Budnitz, Jonathan Safran Foer, Neil Friedenberger, Dora Horn, Nicole Krauss, Ratawat Lapcharonsap, Yiyun Lee, Melly Malloy, ZZ Packer, Akhil Sharma, Gary Steingart. It's a list that many Americans will be familiar with. In fact, readers of The New Yorker probably are familiar with most of those writers.
Yes, many of them have been in The New Yorker. Not them all. And, well, I guess they will, but, I mean, maybe they'll be surprised to know that they have been just deemed as good as I and others think they are.
So where do you go from here? You're leaving Granta after having been there now, what is it, 12 years?
12 years, yes. I'm going to be that dangerous thing, a writer. For a newspaper, The Guardian, and also other things, maybe a book. I have a terribly bad record in book writing. I'm often flatteringly asked if I would like to write a book, and sometimes I succumb, but I always pay back the advance.
Sorry to hear that, really. But you've done okay, haven't you?
I'm fine. I'm a happy man. But, you know, editing and writing are different things. And a lot of my career has been spent editing and fitting in writing around editing. So there comes a time in one's life when you think, well, I'm going to do it now or I'm never going to do it. So I think I've made that decision.
Ian, Jack, is this the last issue?
No, there's one to come from me.
The next to last issue, the penultimate issue of Granta, is the Best of Young American Novelists 2. And I thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That was
a great pleasure.
Come by when you publish that book.
Okay, we'll do.